Originary thinking. In the midst of all deconstruction, Gans attempts to revitalize the sheer notion of community. Contrary to predecessors who still believed some languages were more primitive than others, Gans has made language an all-encompassing world system of morality, as a singular value, and aesthetics as its plural result. I must admit that the rise of theories like his was only a matter of time, though inside of the social and physical destruction which the world has experienced in the last century, time is not entirely to blame. The nature of the capitalist world itself has become as autocratic as the fact of time seems in your theory. I would like to therefore present his explanation of originary thinking, as it so beautifully shows how much of linguistics is linked with economics. Also, Gans explicitly uses the same basic principle I mentioned before. Though he tries to escape the hierarchy of language categories as much as Rousseau in his Origin of Language attempted. However, I will give you my views on Rousseau in the end of my letter to you, as I feel one should end parting with loved ones. Indeed, language has become the word that makes all the difference. Few scientists are happy with the notion that it is merely a means of communication. The general tendency of technological advancement, as well as its result, exchangeable as well as expandable individuals, has recreated the quest of origin. These days not as a differentiation as human beings für sich, as Herder pointed out, but as an attempt to recreate the thought of a species which is bound together as a community. It is a reinvention of the moral capacity of human beings, this time not so much through the obedience to a heavenly defined parameter, but so be it, why not, through the aesthetics of a history of art. And as a discourse of hope and optimism, as Erich Gans begins. The ethical is the supreme human dimension, and what makes it human is its dependence on self-reflective thought. In the face of fragmentation of knowledge, among academic specializations and the proliferation of ethnic group rivalries, our most pressing and intellectual need are not being met by the current victimary discourses, which is to recall our unity as a species. But our unity as a species, would it ever be possible for humans to think in such ethical dimension, would take a rewriting of the premises of science at least, and as this is quite impossible and very unlikely possible, Erich Gans has approached the matter from a reversed historical point of view. Instead of focusing on the origin of language, he focuses on the role of the originary events in human interaction. Let's look at these premises first. They are pretty traditional. Erich Gans too believes that it is imperative that we as human beings make a clear distinction between ourselves as a species and other species of the world, that is, animals, of course. This nevertheless is not necessary to enlighten us as superior beings, but contrary, to make us a bit more modest in the realms of the world as a whole. Erich Gans too believes that the sign is arbitrary, but as the human species is a creature that follows the evolutionary path of becoming instead of being, there must at least, in his view, have been some original event that was memorable enough to create this arbitrariness as a unifying concept. and the human mind can only have recognized and preserved the meaning of the first of the arbitrary signs of language if it received this meaning in a collective act sufficiently memorable for the members of the community to recall it. As a mere possibility, he might be right, but like Stradivarius' bedroom experiences, that memorable event might be denied historically. In Gans's theory, such a memorable event reflects crisis. He does not view human beings as naturally violent. We do, however, need this continuous renewal to be remembered of our violent capacity, because the threat of our existence basically comes from each other. Since every individual possesses a potential threat to the existence of the human community, the renunciation of violence by each of its individual members is the constantly renewed foundations of this community. Now, viewing these premises as relatively correct, how does one go about his business? First, Gans introduces an object of desire. We should imagine that after a successful hunt, people gather around such an appetitive, attractive object, an animal perhaps, and this object immediately is the focus of conflict since it cannot be shared by all members. In spite of Donna Haraway's lengthy discussions on the study of primates, Gans posits that as it is the case with all higher animals, there exists within a group a dominance hierarchy that normally functions to prevent this kind of conflict. Such hierarchies operate not in relation to the group as a whole, but on a one-to-one basis. An individual may challenge the alpha animal for supremacy, but there is within the group neither collective dominance nor collective violence. Well, we hope so, because when it concerns humans, it seems that this potential conflict differentiates from animal hierarchy, as humans are superior in their capacity of mimesis. After all, Aristotle considered man to be the most mimetic animal, and therefore these mimesis must hold the key to human language. This means that if one of the group members wants a piece of the action or desires the object, there is a big chance that all members of the group share this wish. Hence, we have a situation of fearful symmetry. That would mean absolute war if all members of the groups pursued the same gesture to its conclusion. Now, this originary event that Gans described comes in here as a result of human interaction upon this crisis. The focus of conflict becomes the birth of a sacred force, as Gans writes. The center of the circle to possess the repellent sacred force that prevents occupation by the members of the group, that converts the gesture of appropriation into a gesture of designation, that is, into a ostensive sign. Thus the sign arises as a cursive, aborted gesture of appropriation that comes to designate the object rather than attempting to capture it. Here we are actually witnessing the event in terms that Herder would not have dreamed of, as the sign is an economical substitute for its inaccessible reverend. Signs, according to Erik Gans, take the place of objects. If these are sacred, as signs can be reproduced at will, it is a matter of dividing the object equally among the participants, and Gans therefore concludes that This is the foundation of a communal system of exchange, of the material economy. The new linguistic reciprocity is translated into material terms as the principle of equivalent value. And that value is, of course, cultural, not natural. So here we have what Kant calls an originary hypothesis. There is one major difference between Kant's suppositions and yours. You start from the notion of chaos, from which the linguistic sign creates clarity and difference. Kant's starts from the notion of order, which is an instinctual order, that of hierarchy. Also, Kant views the birth of the self within the community against the context of that community. The individual is a latecomer, and the difference between the sign as imaginary fulfillment and the originary scene creates what he calls an originary resentment, as it's the first mode of consciousness. Rather than change being naturally limited by time, as you view change, Kant believed that change is the result of this resentment, which then requires change. In fact, the lateness of the individuals results in a critique of the present. As this critique could not be a universal moral concept, it becomes ethical, which, according to Kant, is rather situational and instead of universal. And these ethics have an aesthetic quality. How can we tell if and when this change occurs? Why? Aesthetic experience reveals the point at which a given ethical system becomes vulnerable to the resentment that provides a central motivation of historical change. Each artwork is an experiment that tests the limits of an ethical system against our intuition of originary crisis. In the midst of all this remains the desirable object, which is primary evocation of the sign as an equalizer, and this process itself gives rise to a moral and divine signified. From this results another notion of the signified, which is a different, a little bit different from yours. The signified conceived not as mental construct but as being is what we call God. And once the sign has been established, thought of a communal and original revelation, a scene of representation which involves thus language, desire, the aesthetics, etc., the idea of God is no longer necessary. Well, here it is. After becoming part of the scene in his book, I could, and you must agree, not have but great admiration for these ideas which explain the whole of mankind. It seems to answer everything and could provide even the biggest cultural pessimist like me with a beautiful dream of human beings who act as relatively independent moral individuals. And this is truly their destination, as they do have this capacity exclusively, for it's not shared by animals, as the utterance of language in contrast to the animal signal system is not genetically fixed. Their content is chosen by the speaker. It makes me wonder if the origin of language, in the midst of this entire cry for modesty, could not be the result of a human superiority complex. True, the original moral thought of Kant's theory comes from a large dead animal desired by all, but the objectification of the animal, who gains little by this moralism, has also given way to the objectification of other desirable objects, which remain fully subjectified throughout the history of mankind. The female of the species, for instance, as a desirable object, has never led to any such moralism. Neither has the objectification of the child of the species. The first is desirable, the second is late. True, for that too, Kant seems to have the solution, which is We learn that we are essentially free and equal when we experience resentment at the unfreedom and inequality. Those who survive inequality and freedom should feel consolidated by this notion. I think, however, that the notion does not change very much, but in fact adds to the general discourse that Gandhi seems to reject in the introduction of his book, and is the main motivation for writing. The ethical is the supreme human dimension, and what makes it human is its dependence on self-reflective thought. In the face of the fragmentation of knowledge among academic specializations and the proliferations of ethnic and group rivalries, our most pressing and intellectual need, one not being met by the current victimary discourses, is to recall our unity as a species. His unity of the species, however, covers the seed of superiority and inferiority. It does not really solve it. Why? Because the sign itself has never been equally distributed among the individuals within the community in the first place. As a mere matter of irony, the history of writing, as well as the history of representation, shows massive exclusion of the objects of desire, as well as a gross discrimination of those who desire the objects. Carolyn Walker Bynum has noticed that the religious practice of women during the Middle Ages was practically left out of the general discourse or altered by the celestial man who had exclusive access to writing. People with oral tradition have been misinterpreted for ages. Such inequality is not caused by the victimary discourse, but by another, more dangerous concept, which underlies the originary scene in linguistics. Gans does one equalizing operation that should differentiate him from the original scene he feels to be created by the birth of individuals. This equalizing operation is one that places morality, ethics, but more important, the rationalization of the sign against the background of pre-existing animal hierarchy. In spite of all the research that has been done by Donna Haraway, who so obviously shows that the far most bulk of theories done towards the hierarchy in the world of primates are so dominated by reflections of human role modeling, Gans economizes nature again. And there are more economic thoughts in his theory. In fact, every attempt made in history to break away from inequality is seen as an equalizing attempt. For instance, it is Christianity in general, in its very hostility to the market, that prepares people for life in market society. Gans forgets that no moral or ethical signification ever prevented people from killing, manipulating, or optimizing their objects of desire. Furthermore, this history, fully grounded on the general idea that individuals are mimicrying each other, and this mimesis is the bottleneck that makes every member of community wanting the same object. Advertisement has learned that the object itself is created as desirable by a deciding group that wants to convince others of the attraction of the object, not to equalize the scene, but to sell worthless pieces of junk as treasures of status. The great equalizer is not the morality of the sign, but the exchangeable constructed value of money and profit, which, contrary, does not equalize participation within the distribution of community, but creates human beings as objects. Now, to view every attempt to break away from this totalizing form as a restoration of the originary event and its moral implication would indeed result in the idea that human inequality is a product of freedom for the moral configuration of the originary scene, a freedom granted by the scene itself. I grant Gans, indeed, that there is no better, more excellently worked out justification for the existing of a liberal capitalist market economy. It does not escape from the history of justification of power, though. That power lies within the creation of the desired object and furthermore within the blackmail of being excluded from the scene. It has little to do with the unity of mankind, as it is the desirable object in the first place that creates the victims of exclusion. It is not the mimetic quality of people, but the manipulation of this mimesis, and therefore the originary scene can never produce freedom in the first place. Today, to be free has resulted in the meaning of not to desire, and it is a vulnerable freedom. Where the original event is concerned, I think rather that I prefer to participate in Stradivarius' bedroom to create a more sensitive onomatopoetic. And this brings us to the heart of the matter concerning the origin of language and its subsequent notion of the arbitrary nature of the sign. Arbitrariness, I must conclude, does not exist between the object and its name, between the feeling and its expression, between the unity of the sensorium and its division through sound. It lies exclusively between the sign and its rationality, or, better yet, its rationalization.